two of them remain silent and watch until the event is over. One of them steps forward because he can't take it anymore. And the servant says to the Duke of Cornwall, who has assumed the right to rule a third of the kingdom, actually half the kingdom now, it's been divided in half, the servant says, "Hold your hand, my lord. I have served you ever since I was a child, but better service have I never done you than now to bid you hold." "Don't you do that," says the servant to the master. "How now, you dog? If you did wear a beard upon your chin, I'd shake it on this quarrel." And he draws his sword, and servant and master fight. The servant wounds Cornwall, and then Regan runs in behind him, stabs the servant in the back and kills him. But he dies, and on what, if you are reading the play and looking at the play as blindly as most of the characters who are ruling it, you say, well, he was disobedient, so he deserved to die. When in fact, what Shakespeare is presenting is a world gone mad in which seeming disobedience is true loyalty. And it continues throughout the play. And indeed, that disobedient Kent disobeys again by returning from exile in disguise to stay with his old master. Well, he's breaking a direct order. How dare he? At his own peril, he's coming back to serve the man who banished him. Why? Love. Loyalty. Recognition of the greatness that is in that man, even though he's gone crazy. It's the complexities of the world in which we now find ourselves. It's here. We live in a world every bit as topsy-turvy, every bit as crazy. Shakespeare knew it well in his own time. He was living in a world where the Catholic Church was being stamped out. And indeed, please notice, Cordelia goes into exile in France. This is not accidental. That's where all those Catholic priests who left England had to go and hide out. France was filled with Catholic priests at that time because they couldn't be in England. And if they did come back to England, they had to come back like Kent in disguise in order to do their good work. Because the English monarchs didn't want them there and would kill them if they found them. Just as Lear would have probably killed Kent if he'd known it was Kent, who had come back, okay, from exile in order to be with him. It is so close to what we're living through, but again, Shakespeare is timeless. Shakespeare is timeless. These patterns reassert themselves over and over, but particularly so at this moment. Much I could say, and I'll tomorrow night I'll go into some of the first scene in more detail. One thing I need to point out, though. Cordelia is dismissed. The two suitors who are there to take her hand, Burgundy and France. Burgundy obviously came for the land. When he finds out she's not getting any, he's not interested anymore. France, however, sees something in this woman that is remarkable. And the fact she has done what she has done makes him more attached to her. Makes him desire her more. And he makes the following little speech. She has just dismissed Burgundy because he's not interested, and she does it very politely. Peace be with Burgundy. Since that respect and fortunes are his love, I shall not be his wife. She is a truth teller. Bingo. But again, it's done coolly and rather politely, but whoa, she nails him. Whereupon France says, "Fairest Cordelia, that art most rich being poor, most choice forsaken, and most loved despised. Be in thy virtues, here I seize upon. Be it lawful, I take up what's cast away." We cannot help but hear the biblical paradoxes, specifically from 2 Corinthians, speaking of Christ, as having nothing yet possessing all things, most rich being poor. Now, I'm not saying Cordelia is Christ, but we are going to follow a pattern here. And Shakespeare establishes it in at least three or four moments during the play where she will act out something of the pattern of love and sacrifice that is personified in our Lord. Shakespeare sets Lear in pre-Christian Britain, and he does it for a reason, I think. given the religious problems of the age, he could not deal directly on the stage with his own beliefs. And I also believe that during the time when he was writing the great tragedies, he went through a period of doubt. He was shaken. Understandably so, given the religious chaos. But there were certain things in him that he understood and that he was trying to grasp more completely. And one of the things he is seeking in Lear, one of its many themes, is the idea of love that is so profound that it is willing to sacrifice itself for that which it loves. The paradox is here. Most rich being poor, most choice forsaken, most loved despised, connected with Cordelia. Come back later when she herself returns from France to lead the troops trying to support her father and says directly, "Oh dear father, it is thy business that I go about." For an audience educated in the faith, the words would have rung out. You know, I must be about my father's business. Very clear. And then finally, the old king himself, after he's recovered his sanity, in Act 5, as the two of them are sent off to prison, says of her directly, speaking of her sacrifice in coming back, fighting for him, and now losing her liberty and about to be locked up, "Upon such sacrifices, my Cordelia, the gods themselves throw incense." He is aware of what she has done for him and the great sacrifice she has made, but obviously there's one more huge sacrifice that she will have to make. On which note the play concludes. I'm pausing there. We'll look at that in a bit. But it's a pattern developed throughout the play, and the pattern says quite simply, if you love, you will sacrifice. Love and sacrifice are one. But where is it coming from? It is coming from something profound inside of her that connects with the truth. We're not just talking the sloppy, externalized love that seems to exist in the two other sisters. We are talking a love of truth translated into a love of one's fellow man, in this case, love of father, in spite of what he's done to her, and then the willingness to sacrifice for him. Truth expressing itself in love and willing to sacrifice him. It's a pattern that runs through the play. And who is she sacrificing for? She is sacrificing for this fallen man. For this man who has chosen to destroy himself, and in doing so, has destroyed the kingdom as well. Nevertheless, she will fight for him and love him and die for him. Now, much of the play, as I said at the beginning of the lecture, is concerned with Lear gaining wisdom. But the wisdom is extraordinarily painful. It begins as early as the fourth scene of the first act. And he's fortunate to have by his side someone else who is loyal, and that's the Fool, one of Shakespeare's greatest creations. The tradition of the Fool had been used by Shakespeare in the comedies. The Fool is always the truth teller. And in fact, the Fool had a license to tell the truth. The Fool was the only one in the court who could say anything to the king and get away with it. Okay? And that's simply because the Fool was the Fool, and if he was a good fool, would make it funny enough so that everyone would sort of have a good laugh, and we can pretend he didn't really mean it. Although if he was a good fool, we know he sure did mean it, and boy, he got right to the center of things, okay? So we have the tradition of the Fool, but what Shakespeare does here, again, is transform the whole notion of the Fool. The Fool is there by Lear's side, remains with him, but we learn, the first thing we hear of the Fool is that the Fool has been desolate since Cordelia left in exile and headed to France. Meaning that the Fool loved Cordelia. What do they have in common? They were both truth tellers. They were both truth tellers. And there was a special love between them. Lear may have banished love. And in banishing his daughter, he banishes love. In banishing Kent, he banishes loyalty. But the fool remains loyal, and the fool loves Lear and can get away with it because he's a fool and can be discounted. And indeed, three quarters of what the fool says is simply comic in nature. But it's very clear every so often when something just comes ringing through. The fool points at Lear at one point and calls him a fool. And Lear says, "Dost thou call me fool, boy?" And the fool says, "All thy other titles thou hast given away. That thou wast born with." Great comic lines. Great comic lines. Although, one scene later, he will come out something that just is so profound it hurts. "If thou wert my fool, nuncle, I'd have thee beaten for being old before thy time." "How's that?" says Lear. "Thou shouldst not have been old till thou hadst been wise." I don't care for George Bernard Shaw much, but he occasionally came out with a good comment. One of them being that at the core of every real jest is a profound truth. And that's one of those moments. That's a truth that just lands like a dagger. Man. Lear's response to that is, "Oh, let me not be mad. Not mad, sweet heavens. I would not be mad. Keep me in temper. I would not be mad." And the truth has landed and hurt so much, he's afraid he's going to lose his mind. In the scene just before, when Goneril says, you have to get these knights out here. I won't have them in my house." He suddenly says, "Oh, most small fault, how ugly didst thou in Cordelia show, which like an engine wrenched my frame of nature from the fixed place, drew from my heart all love and added to the gall. Oh, Lear, 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 beat at this gate that let thy folly in and thy dear judgment out." We're still in the first act. He's pounding on his own head and screaming that he has done something foolish. He knows that by Act 1, Scene 4. We've got another four acts to go. He starts learning the lessons right away. Part of the real problem of playing this part is it is nonstop agony for about 3.5 hours. There is nowhere to hide playing Lear. It is nonstop pain and punishment. And for an actor to make it believable, it's almost unthinkable. There's a rule in the theater, it's sort of an old saw in the theater that says, when you're young enough and have the strength to play King Lear, you can't possibly understand it because you're not old enough. And when you're old enough to understand it, you can't play it because you don't have the strength to get through a performance. The Olivier film that you watched was taped over 2 weeks. The man was dying of cancer as he made it. He had a couple of cancer surgeries. It was the last Shakespeare role he performed. He insisted on doing it. He did many takes, but he was dying. He could never have done that on stage at that point. But part of the power of the performance is that is an old man. Olivier was nearly 80 years old when he did that. And he understood it. He knew what it meant to be that old and to be that foolish. And that's part of the pain of watching that performance. He never could have done it on stage. There's the famous story, Richard Burton was going to play Lear on Broadway. Burton would have been a great Lear. The day they were to sign the contract, he went to the agent's office and the producer's office and looked at the contract and said, "I can't do matinees and evening performances. I can't do that play twice in one day." The producer said, "If you don't, we won't sell tickets. You have to do both." He said, "I can do 6 a week. I can't do 8 a week. The producer said, "Without your name, and if you're not performing, we can't make our money back." And it fell through, and he never played the role, which was a shame. Although one understands, nearly impossible to do that. That's Act One. That's Act One. Act Two, he keeps being battered down, learns more and more. I am going to tomorrow night go through Act Two in some detail. The lessons learned are very specific and very harsh. They are lessons that we need to remind ourselves of constantly. But I hate to make this kind of jump, but I need to do it for time's sake. As the intensity of his own comprehension of what he has done grows, as his mind begins to crack with the burden of the knowledge the recognition of the fact of the tremendous wrong he has done. Shakespeare gives us the external presentation of an internal agony, and the storm erupts. Lear, having given up his castle as king, his home as father, his comfort as a dignified man, races out into that storm. And he suddenly becomes bare, unaccommodated man, ripping the few clothes he has off, half naked beneath the wind, the rain, the lightning. And yet here is part of the glory of this play. For all of the wrong he has done, for all of the wretchedness he has brought on his kingdom, Shakespeare understands the dignity of man in spite of his fallen nature and the fact that there is still something of greatness in him. And Lear does not go out into the storm a poor, forsaken old man. He challenges it. He takes it on. And you have this extraordinary spectacle of an 80-year-old man who has lost everything through his own folly, who finds himself now essentially in the center of a hurricane, challenging the storm. Again, tomorrow night I'm going to go through the poetry of the great opening of Act 3, Scene 2. It's spectacular. But let me just show, just look, those of you that have books, the very first line of Act 3, Scene 2. The fool's by his side. The fool's by his side. The fool will not leave him. The fool leaves the comfort of that lovely twosome, Goneril and Regan, and rushes out into the storm with his master. Lear gets out in the storm, and his first line is, "Blow, winds, and crack your cheeks. Rage! Blow!" He's giving orders. He is commanding the elements. At a moment when we might expect him to become small and weak, he is rising up in the midst of all of this and quite literally becoming king-like again and majestic and giving orders to the heavens themselves. Is it folly? Yes. Will he be obeyed? No. Is it magnificent in its way? And it is, if you will, a core of tragedy in that he's not going to beat that storm. But I can tell you this much, my cat wouldn't take it on. And there's another difference between those little animals. And the fool says, look, everything else has taken shelter. Why are we out here? Okay. I mean, it's a good question. And the reason is there is that in man which is somehow more than nature. There is that in man that strives upward. At the same time, there's that in man which has fallen and drags him down. And there's the conflict internally within the individual soul. Created by God, worthy one day to be in the presence of God, worthy to have the sacrifice made for us so that we could be with God, and at the same time, fallen and sinful and weak. And that is a contradiction that only a Catholic could understand, and only a great Catholic artist could present. Only a great Catholic artist could have this man, this foolish old man, run out into the storm and be majestic. It's paradoxical. It's contradictory. It's fully human in the fullness of what we are, what we've done, what we do, but at the same time, what we hope for, and the fact that we may be redeemed, that we are redeemable because there is something still majestic in us. In the midst of this, he rises up in other ways. Kent comes to him. The fact that they're with him in the midst of this, just extraordinary. And we get another moment of recognition. My wits begin to turn, he says. He knows he's going mad. He knows he's losing it. To the fool, come on, my boy. How dost, my boy? Art cold? I am cold myself. And for the first time, he cares about someone else's well-being. It's the first time in the play he's thought about someone other than himself. But it has taken this much to break him down to that point. The greatest writer of our age, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, says in his great work, The Gulag Archipelago, "Pride grows on the heart of man like lard on a pig." And it's a sad truth. It takes more than we can imagine to strip the pride away from our hearts. And with Lear, we have proud man who suddenly, finally gets enough of that lard stripped away that he can turn and look at the poor fool who's by his side, who's soaking wet, shivering, freezing, and finally say, "How dost, my boy? Art cold?" Oh. It seems the simplest thing in the world, but given who we are, and given this man, it's a triumph. "Where is this straw, my fellow? The art of our necessities is strange and can make vile things precious. Come your hovel. Poor fool and knave, I have one part in my heart that's sorry yet for thee." And he pities another. This is what I mean about growing in wisdom. And these may seem like small moments, but they are overwhelming. They come to the hovel. This is the king, looking forward to bedding down in straw. Wait a minute, a king bedding down in straw? Sounds familiar. But the notion is, again, the coming of humility. And I am not, again, saying that Lear is a Christ figure. He is someone who suffers. And he is someone who, for various reasons, is in a different element than we would expect to find him in. But my point is this. This play is loaded with Christian iconography wherever you turn, even though Shakespeare sets it in pre-Christian times because he doesn't want to deal directly with it. He could have gotten in real trouble, and we have the sense he wasn't a courageous man. But it's all there. All the ideas are working there. We come to the hovel, and he turns to the fool and says, "In, boy, go first. You houseless poverty, nay, get thee in. I'll pray, and then I'll sleep." And he kneels down in the dark, in the night, in front of the hovel of straw, and says, "Poor naked wretches, wheresoe'er you are, that bide the pelting of this pitiless storm, how shall your houseless heads and unfed sides, your looped and windowed raggedness, defend you from seasons such as these? Oh, I have ta'en too little care of this. Take physic, pomp. Expose thyself to feel what wretches feel, that thou mayest shake the superflux to them and show the heavens more just." He is suddenly concerned for his whole kingdom. He suddenly realizes in his 80th plus year that there are people out in his kingdom who are cold and without homes, and says, "Oh, I have ta'en too little care of this." But it took this much to bring him to this point. It took this much to strip that pride away. And then we get this bizarre scene. Edgar's in there pretending to be mad. Lear is in there actually going mad. The fool is in there speaking foolishness. And there is poor Kent, who can't even admit who he is. And they're gathered together in this little hovel in the midst of the storm, and you know what? There's more loyalty and love and justice and good sense there than in that warm palace where Goneril and Regan and Cornwall and Edmund are all gathered together, warm and dry and thinking the world of themselves. And we suddenly have two scenes, two balanced scenes of justice, so-called justice, where Lear sees a three-pronged stool and thinks it's Goneril and says they have to put her on trial. And putting her on trial, he looks at the stool and says, "Is there any cause in nature that makes these hard hearts? How could they do this to me?" he asks. And inside, there's a trial going on in which they decide, because the Duke of Gloucester has sought to assist his king, they'll now put out his eyes, and they call it justice. There is no justice in the courts of Britain. There is mad justice out in the hovels. And it's closer to reality than what's going on elsewhere. A world turned upside down. A world gone completely mad. The fool disappears at this point. It's one of the great mysteries. It's one of the great mysteries in Shakespeare's studies. Why does this magnificent character vanish in the middle of the play? There are a couple of reasons, a couple of possibilities. One is simply this. He's done his job. He can only be helpful while Lear can hear him and understand him. And when Lear goes mad, there is no dramatic purpose to the fool any longer. There may be a practical stage problem, which was this. We know that there was a great deal of doubling that went on when these plays were first performed. One actor playing multiple parts. The fool doesn't appear until Cordelia goes to France. The fool vanishes in Act 3 just before Cordelia returns from France. It is entirely possible the same actor in the original production played both Cordelia and the fool. We'll never know. But there is an odd moment at the end when Lear comes in carrying the dead Cordelia in his arms, looks at her and says, "And my poor fool is hanged." Fool, a term of endearment, meaning my beloved one is hanged, that's Cordelia. But if it was the same actor who had played the two parts, we have a shock of double recognition. We can't know, but it's a fascinating possibility. The best reason I ever heard came from a friend of mine. I'd spent a class and we'd spent some time discussing and debating why the fool vanishes in Act 3. When I teach Lear, I take 3 or 4 weeks, sometimes 5 weeks. Sometimes I can't get out of the play at all. So we had spent a class talking about the fool, and the question come up, why does the fool vanish? Various possibilities. I went home and a friend of mine called me who knows Lear very well, and he said, "What are you teaching?" I said, "Lear." He said, "Well, what'd you talk about today?" I said, "We talked about why the fool disappears in the middle of the play." He says, "It's very simple." I said, "It is." He said, "Yeah, it's very simple." I said, "Why? What's the answer? Why does the fool vanish?" He said, "Because the play isn't funny anymore." Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And the fact of the matter is the first half of Lear is in its way very funny. There's a lot of humor in it. There isn't in the second half. There's not a laugh to be found. It gets grim. It gets exceedingly grim, and hence the comic character is gone. The comic character vanishes. He is gone. I only have a few moments. I'm going to have to wrap up quickly. I'll go through much of the rest of this tomorrow night. Let me just say this. Act 4 contains, I'm quoting another professor now, there's great wisdom in this remark too, who once said, Act 4 of King Lear contains 3 of the most remarkable scenes in all of drama. It contains the most grotesque scene ever written. Okay, that is the ridiculous attempted suicide of Gloucester. When he thinks he's at the edge of the mountain, he's actually on flat ground, and he attempts to commit suicide by throwing himself off a cliff, and there's no cliff, and just goes blammo right down flat on the ground. It's a bizarre scene. I will talk about that tomorrow night, I promise. It also contains the most moving scene ever written, and that's the reunion of Cordelia and Lear. When he wakes up from his madness, and father and daughter are reunited. I can't even really talk about that scene. It's beyond me. It's one of those moments I embarrass myself in public. The last time I tried to teach it and go through it and explain it, I honestly reached the point, and it's only happened to me once or twice in my teaching career, I couldn't talk. It just welled up to here, and I realized I was about to embarrass myself in front of all, so I just closed the book and left the room. And the class had no idea what had happened. A couple of them had a sense that, you know, the old man was about to lose it and he had to leave. The last, it's in Act 5, the last, of course, the most unbearable moment in all literature, and that is enter Lear with Cordelia dead in his arms. I'll go through the Act 4 scenes tomorrow night, but let me just say this about that final moment. There were earlier versions of King Lear. Shakespeare's was not the first. The story was known. It wasn't hugely popular. The story had been known in other versions. Which means when the audience showed up on opening day to see King Lear by Shakespeare, they had certain expectations. In the other versions, we have a happy ending. Cordelia comes back from France, fights for her father, wins the battle, and either restores him to the throne or she takes the throne herself. That's how it had been done. Because there is in this play a fairy tale element. Once upon a time, there was a king who had three daughters. And we've got a touch of Cinderella here. We've got the two wicked sisters and the good princess, okay? That's here. And such a story demands a happy ending. And at the end, the good daughter comes back and gets everything, okay? And those expectations had to be in the audience, not just because the pattern demands it, but also because earlier versions had given that. Imagine, if you will, it's Christmas time, and word comes there's going to be a brand new Christmas Carol on TV. And everybody in America sits down to watch it because it's starring Sylvester Stallone as Scrooge. So it's going to be hugely popular, and everybody tunes in, and they sit down, and, you know, it's just... They've seen the three of the films, and they've seen the Mickey Mouse Christmas Carol and the Mr. Magoo Christmas Carol, and they sit down to watch it, and we come to the end, and the three ghosts visit Scrooge, and Scrooge at the end says, I don't care about those ghosts, and fires Bob Cratchit, who has a miserable Christmas, can't feed Tiny Tim anymore, who dies of hunger, and it ends with Scrooge taking Tiny Tim's crutch and breaking it for firewood. Now I'm giving an extreme case, but the fact of the matter is, if on Christmas Eve America tuned in and was watching that, they would sit in horror, in absolute horror, in disbelief at what they were seeing. But what would happen is they would be hit with something that is in its way profoundly true, because these things happen in the world. And suddenly, at the end of Lear, when people were expecting, what do we get? Enter Lear with Cordelia in his arms. Ho, 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 ho. Oh, you are men of stones. Had I your tongues and eyes, I would use them so that heaven's bolt should crack. And for the rest of the play, Lear looks at the dead corpse of Cordelia in his arms, trying to find a sign of life. The audience expected a happy ending, and what do they get? A kind of vision of the Pietà. Only here it is the father holding the dead daughter. And what has that daughter done? Sacrificed herself for her father out of love. And the sacrifice, as Shakespeare insists, is not just suffering humiliation, not just suffering exile, not just coming back to fight for him, even though he's done you wrong, but going to death for him if that is necessary. Love means sacrifice. Even unto death. And the play ends with us staring at the fact of death. The play ends, if you will, with a crucifixion. And Shakespeare makes the audience stare at that crucifixion. And for hundreds of years, people have not been able to stand it because they were moving away from the fact of what that crucifixion represented. From 1680 until 1838, a rewritten version of King Lear held the stage with a happy ending. Shakespeare's version was not done in England for 150 years. They put the happy ending back on it. The great Dr. Johnson, the first great Shakespeare editor and the first great Shakespeare critic, said that after the first time he read the play, he never read it again until he had to edit it, because he found the ending unbearable. And it is in its way unbearable, because there is nothing more unbearable than to lose the ones we love. It's even worse if we lose the ones we love because of our own folly. It is even worse to lose the ones we love through our own sin and folly if that one we should have loved and did not is God itself, God himself, who's made the sacrifice. I'm not saying Cordelia is Christ. I am saying Shakespeare is forcing us to look at the meaning of the sacrificial death. And he will not avert his gaze. And those lines at the end are apocalyptic as Lear comes in. And we hear Albany, Kent, Edgar, is this the promised end? Or image of that horror? Fall and cease. Shakespeare in his later plays will go on to look at the resurrection. That's what the romances are about. But at this moment in his intellectual development, at this moment in his own pain, he focuses on that crucifixion and sets it in a pre-Christian era, recognizing if there is not Christ, then when will Cordelia return? As Lear says, never, 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 never. A line of inverted iambic pentameter. Trochaic pentameter. And the very verse that Shakespeare wrote in for his entire career is inverted. Goes backward. As death inverts life. The play is honest. The play is direct. The play is unsettled. I've only touched on it here tonight. I'll go into it in more depth tomorrow. Thank you. I've left time for just a couple of questions. I apologize. I yammered on as I tend to do. If anybody has a couple of quick questions, I'll be glad to take more questions tomorrow.
Cruel speech, right before he vanishes across the Merlin.
Yes.
That for a second.
Yeah. It's an oddity. It's one of those moments. The fool often speaks cryptically, if you will, and the other curiosity is on stage. It's often very difficult to get a sense of what he is saying. I'm turning to it right now. There is, again, in the speech, the sense of a world turned upside down. And what he is giving a vision of is what will happen. Oh, my. I don't have my usual book here. In any case. What the fool is doing at that moment is giving a comic sense of inversion, okay? When priests are more in word than matter, okay? We get a whole list of things that seem to be inversions where things are coming apart. And then he says, then Albion shall come to confusion. The fact of the matter is, it's there. It's already there. He is making a prophecy, in a sense, that's already fulfilled. That's already fulfilled. And it's one of those moments when it seems to be cryptic and prophetic, but it's the fool telling it like it is in the here and now. And then he ends it with a double reversal. He says, this prophecy shall Merlin make, you know, in the future, because I live before his time. And it's one of those moments where you can barely, if he lives before Merlin, how could he know that Merlin was going to come? But it's also a moment, and Shakespeare will do this occasionally, of forcing an audience to remember they're in a theater. He will often, at moments of high drama, make people remember this is still just a play. And that's one of those moments where I think the fool is there to relieve some of the tension because he's saving up for what's coming later, to hit later in the play. But the prophecy is already there. The things he says in that speech are already there. Yeah, it's already happened. Anything else? Yes.
Is challenging the elements, is that usually considered a tragic flaw by a tragic hero?
It's something you don't often, in its way, it's something that's fairly new in this play. Look, there is something mad in challenging the elements. And you don't find it really again until Moby Dick, where Ahab challenges the sea. If you go back to the Greeks, you wouldn't find anything like that, because Greek tragedy is so social in nature. And again, even if it's dealing with fate, they may challenge fate, but they wouldn't challenge the elements as such. It happens in this play as part of a mark of Lear's coming madness, that he'll take on the storm. He'll take on the storm. There isn't really a moment like it anywhere else in Shakespeare. And as I said, aside from Moby Dick, I can't think of another moment quite like it anywhere in literature. It's a moment of sheer madness. But of course, Ahab is mad as well. Because if you take on a hurricane, you're not going to win. If you take on the sea, you're not going to win. Which means you've got to be goofy to even attempt it. It's just strange. Yeah.
This is with Moby Dick.
Yeah.
Did Ahab ever come to knowledge of his tragic choice?
There are a couple of tiny moments, but small ones. Very small ones. There is very little. And it is part of what marks it, I think, as an American tragedy. That even as the ship is going down, he won't acknowledge what's happened. He will not. He refuses to learn. Melville, by the way, when he was writing Moby Dick, had immersed himself in King Lear and Macbeth. He had read those plays over and over and over and over again. And you get little moments, you know, clear parallels. Ahab with the little black boy Pip at his side is stolen right from Lear. Okay. But transformed and made wonderful. T.S. Eliot had the wonderful line, mediocre artists plagiarize, great artists steal. And Melville was a great artist and steals Lear and his Fool, but transforms them so completely you get something completely new. And within that work, completely original. But it's an obvious theft. It's just a direct theft, but who cares? Because what he does with it is just magnificent. Simply magnificent. Yeah. Yeah.
The very end of the play, you talk on the words, weep if you're young.
Oh, yes, yeah. it's a wonderful speech there at the end. By the way, it's interesting, controversial again. In the original quarto version, when the play was published individually, those lines are given to Albany. In the folio version, the first collected works of Shakespeare, it's given to Edgar. It's a debate as to who's supposed to say them. I vote for Edgar, but that's another story. The weight of this sad time, we must obey, speak what we feel, not what we ought to say. We begin with the notion of obedience to the time. And the time is tragic. Let me say one thing. Those words always ring for me with Shakespeare's voice of living in England at that time of religious turmoil. That's part of it. It is the notion of speaking from the heart. It's a justification of Cordelia, who oddly, we realize by the end of the play, at the beginning did speak from the heart more than her sisters did. Not what we ought to say, which is sort of that which is expected of us. And it takes us all the way back to the beginning, the opening scene. The oldest hath borne most. It's a recognition on the part of young Edgar, whom I have neglected tonight. Edgar is hugely important. I'll talk about him tomorrow night. The oldest hath borne most, we that are young. The young man, Edgar, says, we will never go through anything like that. One reason why? We that are young shall never see so much, nor live so long. It's not possible to experience that much ever again, because the young are now wrecked, and the young don't have the chance of living to the age of Gloucester and Lear. And you have a sense of time itself contracting. Edgar, in a sense, by the end of the play, is an old man. Everyone has aged. Not in terms of years, because they'll never last that long. Edgar and Albany will now rebuild the kingdom. They'll pull the pieces back together so it can go on. But what are they pulling together? A shattered world, a fragmented world, trying to do what they can. And the notion is they have already lived a lifetime. They have already, but it's also a mark of respect for their elders. And it's a kind of, at the end, Edgar puts a blessing on his father in spite of what his father did to him, and says a blessing for the old king. These were great men. In spite of what they did. In spite of what they did. Kent, of course, the final tribute, refuses to join them in rebuilding the kingdom, and simply says, "I have a journey, sir, shortly to go. My master calls me. I must not say no." He said, "I'm going to die. I'm about to follow my master into death. I'm worn out. I can't start rebuilding. I'm too old. I'm too worn out. I will now die like my master, the king, did, and it's the final act, sort of obedience. I will now follow my master once again." It's a dark ending. It's a dark and painful ending. but there's a sense of justice that rings through it too. I'll talk about that notion tomorrow night as well. That comes out of the Edgar Edmund Gloucester plot, and is as disturbing in its own way as the vision of the necessary sacrifice of Cordelia. This is a profoundly disturbing play. As profoundly disturbing as the truth itself. It's not simple or easy or pretty. And that recognition that I don't know anywhere else where the notion of take up your cross and follow me is presented as painfully as it is here. And the notion of what that means, it's one of those words we use. It's a phrase we use. I mean, our Lord said it. We try to understand it. But here, the weight, the pain, the suffering is realized in an unbelievable manner. I cannot imagine what it took for this man to write this. I cannot conceive of it.
The King of France, he never...
never comes back.
There was no symbolic reason for it.
I don't think there is. Again, characters vanish in this play. I think the reason is he goes on to play Edgar. Another one of those doubling. Okay? And again, there's a way in which it makes a kind of sense. Because Edgar is quite literally the knight in shining armor who is fighting side by side with Cordelia. So she comes back, but notice again, and this is, I think, hugely important. Who comes back from France? The Queen. The Queen comes back. And there, for those suppressed Catholics in England, to know that the church was hiding out in France, the suffer, you know, the exiled, the one that had been cast out, and suddenly Cordelia returns from France as Queen, bearing that sword. But Shakespeare won't sentimentalize and say, therefore everything's just fine. He reminds what? Well, if she is who she is, then what? She must suffer and die. Powerful stuff. That's a personal theory of mine. Personal theory of mine. Yeah. More tomorrow if you want to come back. I'll be here still talking tomorrow night if you want to come back.